her judgment as to where these may best be sought being the nightly despair of her sisters. She never needs to touch her hair, and it is always perfect. Cornelia's room, anxious as others in the house upon the topic of nubility and its unforeseen woes, has forbidden his daughters to eat any of the native cookery, particularly that of the Malay, in his belief that the spices encourage adolescence into sin, by which he means lust that crosses racial barriers. For it is real. He has known it to appear more than once, here and up in the country where his brothers and their families live. He keeps loaded elephant guns in both the front hallway and the dispense in back. Deep in the curfew hours, in bed with his pipe, he imagines laughter outside the windows, even when the wind drowns out every sound, slave laughter. He knows they watch him, and he tries to pay close attention to the nuances of their speech. Somewhat as his neighbors each strenuous Sunday profess belief in the great struggle at the end of the world, so does Cornelius, inside his perimeter of Mauritian smoke at the hour when nothing is lawfully astir but the rattle watch and the wind, find in his anxious meditations no release from the coming Armageddon of the races. This European settlement so precarious, facing an unknown interior with the sea at their backs, forced step after step by the steadfast gravity of all Africa down into it at last. It is another way of living where the sea is ever higher than one's head and kept out only provisionally. The first moment they find themselves in a room together, Jet hands Mason a hairbrush. "There's a bit in back I can't reach. Please give it a dozen strokes for me, Charles." Nor does she allow just anyone to do this. Greet, entering, crossing, and exiting, "I hope you feel honored, sir," with a look back over her shoulder that is anything but reproachful. A moment later she's back, with Els, who comes skipping over to Mason, and without a word, lifting her skirt, sits upon his lap in a sinuous motion, allowing the lace hems to drop again, before squirming about to glance at his face. "Now then, my English teapot," reaching to pinch his cheek, by now well aflame, "shall I tell you what she really wants you to do with that hairbrush?" "Els, you imp from hell, I shall shave your head. Mr. Mason is a gentleman who would never have such designs upon my bodily comfort." Putting out her hand for the return of the hairbrush, "would you, Charles?" Mason sits, torpedoed again. To refuse to return the brush would be to issue an invitation she might accept. Yet if he hands it back, she'll shrug and go flitting on, tossing her hair about, to someone marginally more interesting. And he'll face hour upon insomniac hour with the fevers of erotic speculation ever dispelled by the cold bath of annoyance at himself. Els continues meanwhile to reposition her nether orbs upon Mason's lap, to his involuntary, though growing, interest. Greet comes over to place her hand on his brow. "Are you well, sir? Is there anything I may bring you?" Fingertips lightly descending to his already assaulted cheek, her eyes crescent and heated. Her lips, at least as he will recall this later, begin to part and come closer. "Girls," Johanna bustling in, "you are disturbing Mr. Mason, 'tis obvious," and, switching to Cape Dutch, "in here it begins to smell like the slave's chambers." The three maidens immediately snap to attention, lining up in order of height, trying without success to avoid all gaze-catching. When they have been sent away cackling, their mother places an unpremeditated hand upon Mason's arm. As a man of science, you understand the role of humors in adolescent behavior and will not respond, I hope, too passionately. Is that the word, passionately? Good vrouw, rest easy. These days passion knows me not, alas. She gazes long enough at his member, still erect from the posterior attentions of her youngest daughter, before looking him in the eye. "I cannot imagine, then, how 'twill be once you and it are reacquainted." "Should that occur," says Mason, fatally, but not yet mortally, "pray feel welcome to attend and observe it first hand." She looks away at last, and in the release Mason feels an impulse to smite the wall repeatedly with his head. "Then again, your duties may oblige you to be elsewhere." She brushes against him on her way out the other door, raking him with a glistening stare. "Oh, too late for that, good sir, far too late." What is wrong with this family? He feels stranded out at the end of some unnaturally prolonged peninsula of obligation, whilst about to be overwhelmed by great combers of alien lusts. Now he recognizes the hairbrush dilemma in a different form. This time, whatever he may say in reply will be taken and morphosed however Johanna wishes. He feels a sudden rush of exemption. It does not matter what he says. That night, the sky too cloudy for work, Mason is awakened by the naked limbs of a slave girl who has entered his bed. Dixon is not yet returned, though 'tis well past the gunfire. "What the deuce?" is his gallant greeting. "And who are you, then?" He recalls having seen her in the company of various room girls. "Alstra, good sir. 'Tis a common name here for slaves." "The South." He is peering at her in the moonlit room. "I am Mason, Charles Mason." She takes his chin twixt her thumb and finger. "A few basic points, sir. First, no unnatural activities. Second, no opium, no daga, no ardent spirits, no wine, and so on. Third, their wish is that I become impregnated, if not by you, then by one of you. All that the mistress prizes of you is your whiteness, understand? Don't feel disparaged. Every white male who comes to this town is approached by every Dutch wife upon the same topic. The baby, being fairer than its mother, will fetch more upon the market. There it begins, there it ends." "What? No sentiment? No love? No... excuse me, approached? Ah, of course. Was I imagining myself the first? And you, how many of these expensive little slaves have you borne her?" "Why be angry with me, sir? She is the mistress. I do as she bids." "Why, in England, no one has the right to bid another to bear a child." "Oh, white wives are much alike, and all their secrets are common knowledge at the market. Many have there been, obliged to go on bearing children, for no reason but the man's pride. Our women are free." "Our? Oh, hark yourself. How is English marriage any different from the service I'm already in?" "You must marry an Englishman and see." "Not today, sailor. Yet take warning. The mother will set her three cubs upon ye without mercy, and make her own assaults as well, all of it intended to keep this rigid with your desire. And the only one in the house you'll be allowed to touch is me." "This? I say, what's that you're doing there? You really ought not to." "Having but an innocent squeeze, sir. Keep me in mind. I'll tell them I couldn't wake you up." She proceeds carefully as she may to the door, expecting at every step to be assaulted. He snorts and paws the counterpane, but doesn't charge. Exiting, looking back over a dorsal scape immediately occupying all of Mason's attention, "See you tomorrow at breakfast. Remember to save one of those cute frowns for me." And, dammy, she's off. Next morning, none of the five sprites is able to engage the eyes of any other. Dixon wolfs down griddle cakes and orange juice, whilst Mason glumly concentrates upon the coffee and its rituals. Cornelius comes in briefly to light his pipe and nod before proceeding to his work, which involves a good deal of screaming at the slaves. Mason's day, long and fatiguing, is spent popping in and out of doors, being caught alone in different rooms with different females of the household by others who then contrive to return the favor. Only slowly does it dawn on him that this goes on here all the time, being likely the common life of the house, and that he but happens to have stumbled into it as some colorful figure from the fringes of the world, here for a while and then gone, just enough time for everyone, barring some unannounced bolt of passion finding a target, to make use of him, perhaps not quite time enough for them to come to despise him. So Mason prays for clear nights and perfect seeing. Nonetheless, his throat closes and dries. His heart's rhythm picks up whenever the clouds cover the sunset, and the fog rolls swiftly all the way up to the observatory, and over it, and on up, and he knows he'll be facing anywhere up to five distinctively motivated adventuresses, each of whom, as in some fiendish Asian parlor game, is scheming against the other four, the field having shifted from motives of pleasure to motives of reproduction and commerce. It's being for them a given that nothing of a romantic nature will occur. Nothing does. Mason is usually left with an inflexible object which, depending upon the breeches he's wearing that day, not to mention the coat, is more or less visible to the public, who, at any rate, as it proves, are quite used to even less inhibited displays. Dixon does his best not to mention it, waiting rather for Mason either to brag or to complain. Eventually, "I know what you're looking at. I know what you're thinking." "Who, I, Mason? Well, what am I supposed to do about it? First, get out of the house." Mason makes quick head turns to left and right and lowers his voice. "Whilst you've been out rollicking with your Malays and pygmies, what have you heard of the various sorts of magic that they are said to possess?" Dixon has, in fact, heard from an assortment of companions native to the Dutch Indies tales of sorcery, invisible beings, daily efforts to secure shelter against demonic infestation. "They are not as happy nor as childlike as they seem," he tells Mason. "It may content us, as unhappy grown Englishmen, to think that somewhere in the world innocence may yet abide, yet 'tis not among these people. All is struggle, and all but occasionally in vain." Mason cocks his head, trying to suppress a certain quiver that also gives him away when at cards, a bodily desire to risk all upon a single trick. "Would you happen to enjoy entree to this world of sorcery? I am anxious as to protection." "A spell?" Dixon suggests. "Emphatically not a love potion, you understand. No, no, quite the contrary indeed." Dixon, to spare himself what might else prove to be evenings full of complaint, says, "I've met people who are said to possess a special power. The Balinese word is sakti. It has not, however, always been successful against Dutchmen. Would this be a hate potion, then, that thou require?" "Well, certainly not hate. Inconvenient as love in its own way. No, more of an indifference draught, is more what I had in mind. 'Twould have to be without odor or taste, and require but a few drops. I could have a look about, though 'tis more common here to accept what they happen to offer." Difficult indeed are the next few nights as Dixon, searching the Malay quarter for an elixir to meet Mason's specifications, beneath lampless staircases, in the bloody lulls of cockfights, is merrily insulted from one illicit grotto to another. "Oh, they've heard of the filter, all right. 'Tis quite in demand. In fact, as much by one sex as the other." As the company seeks to confine all the Dutch of the Cape Colony behind a boundary it has drawn, and to rule them radially from a single point, the least immoderate of feelings in such a closed volume may prove lethal. Over the mountains, to keep all tranquil, entire tribes work day and night shifts trying to supply a lively market. Imitations and counterfeits abound. Mason is not seeking the potion for himself. Rather, his scheme is to introduce it into the soup bowl of his hostess, who is kept tuned to her own dangerous pitch through the attentions of a number of young slave girls chosen for their good looks. They haunt her, whisking the flies from her skin, oiling it when the southeaster makes it dry as pages of a Bible, draping it with silks from India and France. They feed her pomegranates, kneeling quickly to lick off the juice that runs down her hand before it reaches her sleeve. Cornelius has a peep in from time to time. Though he usually departs with an erection, it is possible that he is feeling the pain of an ineptly shot beast. But his expression doesn't change. He sucks upon his pipe, removes it from his mouth to cough, and continuing to cough, ambles away. In Johanna's intrigue to bring together Mason and her senior slave, however, 'tis the slavery, not any form of desire, that is of the essence. Dixon, out of these particular meshes, can see it. Mason cannot. Indifferent to visibility, wrapped in the melancholy winds that choir all night long, persists an obsession or siege by something much older than anyone here, an injustice that will not cancel out. Men of reason will define a ghost as nothing more otherworldly than a wrong unrighted, which, like an uneasy spirit, cannot move on, needing help we cannot usually give, nor always find the people it needs to see, or who need to see it. But here is a collective ghost of more than household scale. The wrongs committed daily against the slaves, petty and grave ones alike, going unrecorded, charmed invisible to history, invisible yet possessing mass and velocity, able not only to rattle chains but to break them as well. The precariousness to life here, the need to keep the ghost propitiated day to day via the company's merciless priesthoods and many-volumed codes, brings all but the hardiest soul sooner or later to consider the primary questions more or less undiluted. Slaves here commit suicide at a frightening rate, but so do the whites, for no reason, or for a reason ubiquitous and unaddressed, which may bear acquaintance but a moment at a time. Mason, as he comes to recognize the sorrowful nakedness of the arrangements here, grows morose, while Dixon makes a point of treating slaves with the courtesy he is never quite able to summon for their masters. Yet they entertain prolonged fantasies upon the topic. They take their joy of it. Astronomy in a realm where slavery prevails, slaves holding candles to illuminate the ocular threads, whilst others hold mirrors should we wish another angle. One might lie supine, zenith star position all night, being fanned, fed, amused, everyone else obliged to remain upon their feet, ever a tip, to respond to a gazer's least velity, ire. Mason, why thus disgusting? Come, come, and you're ever telling me to lighten up my fizz. I have found it of help, Dixon, to think of this place as another planet whither we have journeyed, where these Dutch-speaking white natives are as alien to the civilization we know as the very strangest of pygmies. Help? It doesn't help. What art thou talking about? They've a personal interest here, thy sentiments engaged, for all I know. My sentiments? Sentiments in this place? A rix dollar a dozen today, tomorrow, wherever the company shall peg them. The Dutch company, which is everywhere and everything. Somewhat like the deist's god, do thy mean? Late blow, late blow. Mason, of mathematical necessity, there do remain, beyond the reach of the VOC, routes of escape, pockets of safety, markets that never answer to the company, gatherings that remain forever unknown, even down in Butterbag Castle. I'd be much obliged if we might roam round together some evening, and happen we'll see. Mind, I'm seldom all the way outside their perimeter, yet I do make an effort to keep to the margins close as I may. And I'm making no effort, is that it? You're accusing me of servility, sloth? You're never about. How would you know how hard I'm working? Do not imagine me taking any more joy of this than you do. Come then. There's too much sand in the air tonight for any decent obs. Zemons and vrooms, all cataleptic from those winds, none shall miss us. Mayn't we be carefree mice for a few hours at least? He receives a blurred and strangely prolonged gaze. I wish I knew where my affection for you runs. One moment, 'tis sure, is the heart yarn of a mainstay. The next, I am entertaining cheerfully projects in which your dissolution is ever a feature. Calling off the wedding again. We must try not to weep. For an instant, both feel, identically, too far from any place, defenseless behind this fragile salient into an unknown, too deep for one lifespan, that begins directly behind Table Mountain. They do, to be sure, go out that evening, as into various others together, in search of lustful adventure. But each time Mason will wreck things, scuttling hopes, however sure, frightening off the doxies with gothical chat of headstones and diseases of the mind, swilling down great, and occasionally, Dixon is told, exceptional Constantia wines with the sole purpose of getting drunk, exploding into ill-advised song, losing consciousness face first into a variety of food and drink, including more than one of the most exquisite curries this side of Sumatra. That is, proving a difficult carousing partner, blocked from simple enjoyment in too many directions for Dixon to be at all angered, rather marveling at him, as a fairgoer might at some curiosity of nature. Mason, no less problematic indoors than out, being an uneasy sleeper, begins at about this time to dream of some presence with a crease or Malay dagger, of indistinct speech, yet clear intention to douse for the wellspring of Mason's blood. He wakes up screaming, repeatedly. At length, Alstra, expressing the will of both houses, sends him to talk with a certain Toko, a Negrito or Asian pygmy of a Malay tribe called the Senoi. It is their belief that the world they inhabit in their dreams is as real as their waking one. At breakfast each morning, families sit and report their dreams to one another. offering advice and opinions pass him, as if all the fantastical beings and events be but other villagers and village gossip. They live their dreams, Mason reports to Dixon, whilst we deny everything we may witness during that third of our precious span allotted, as if sleep be too much like death to advert to for long. It is at some point that night, after securing the second altitude of Shaula, that the astronomers agree to share the data of their dreams whenever possible. After those initiatory hours together upon the Seahorse, having found no need to pretend a whole list of pretenses, given thereby a windfall of precious time, neither is surprised at how many attunements, including a few from dream life, they may find between them. "Heaven help me," Mason muttering sourly, "my dreams reveal this town to be one of the colonies of hell, with the Dutch company acting as but a sort of caretaker for another, embodying of powers, ye'd say, altogether, everyday life as they live it here, being what hell's colonials have for routs and redottos. Why, eyelids clenched apart, my own dreams are very like, though without the Dutch company, more like a gala that never stops. Think thee 'tis all this Malay food we're eating every day?" Mason has a brief excursion outside himself. "You're enjoying this miserable viper plantation. Why, damme, if you're not going to miss it when we're shut of it at long last. Arr, arr, what shall you do for ketchup? They must sell it somewhere in London, at 10 times the price. Then I shall have to learn a receipt for it." The next time the tall figure with the wavy blade approaches him, Mason, willing to try anything, stands his ground, and with the help of certain Gloucestershire shin-kicking arts, actually defeats his assailant. "Keep your face down," Mason tells the adversary. "I do not wish to see your face." "You must then demand something from him," Toko has advised. "Some solid gift you may bring back with you." "The crease," says Mason. Silently, the bowed figure throws it on the ground to one side. Mason stoops and picks it up. "Thank you." When he wakes, there it is, the point lying nearly within the portal of one nostril. A wrong turn in his sleep might have been the end. Despite its look of forge-fresh perfection, 'tis not a virgin blade. Tiny scratches, uncleansable stains, overlie one the other in a palimpsest running deep into the dimension of time. "Happen 'twill be those girls teasing with thee." "Why, thank ye, blight, what would a day be without a common-sense remark from you?" "One of us must provide a datum line of sanity, and as it seems unlikely to be thee, are the most intimate of acts, the trustful sharing of a dream, taken and used against the master by his own sly prentice. Begging thy mercy, sir, let us not venture into the terre mauvais of professional resentment, or we shall certainly miss the culmination of Shaula, that sting e'er poised above the pates of this unhappy people, to strike which, and which not, who can say? The very voice of responsibility astronomic, was ever stargazer more fortunate than I to be seconded to this angelical correctness? And yet, despite you, Dixon, do you know what the imp calls, it advises me, whom better to bore with the unabridged tale of your woeful treatment by the world you so desperately wish to be loved by, I unto ravishment, than this unreflective Geordie here? At least he understands some astronomy, is usually how it goes. And being your second, Dixon bats back, he has no choice but to listen. Just so, and take notes if you wish, for some day, lad, you'll be running your own expedition, bearing all the weight of leadership, which crusheth a man even as it bloateth his pride. I'm miraculous. Perhaps with some luck you'll come to know the relief indescribable of shedding that load, dumping months, even years of accumulated resentment in one great, if thou don't mind. Oh, of course, I hadn't realized. 'Tis but our uninhibited earthiness, we of lower degree, we're forever speaking of shit, you see, without much. Dammy, I said shit, didn't I? Oh, shit, I've said it again. No, twice. Smacking himself repeatedly upon the dome. Be easy, Mason, it's all right. You'll report me now? Be happy to, if I thought anyone would believe it. Wouldn't want you getting into any trouble, Mason, unable to refrain from adding, Spanish inquisitors or whatever. Indulge me, sir, that word again was... Oh, for heaven's sake, authorities, if you like, if that's not too sectarian for you. I am not a fucking Jesuit, Mason. If Jesuits are manipulating me, then are we two punches in a droll booth, friend? For as certainly would it be the East India Company who keep thee ever in motion. Ah, and how is that exactly? Some day, someone will ask, how did a baker's son get to be assistant to the Astronomer Royal? How did a Geordieland surveyor get to be his second on the most coveted stargazing assignment of the century? Happened 'twas my looks? Thy charm? Or are we being used by forces invisible even to thy invisible college? Whatever my station, bristling, I have earned it. Though frankly, I have wondered about you. A collier's son, a land sale collier at that. Surely there's more wealth and respect in sea coal. Aye, and we're Quakers as well. Is there a nervus probandi about some place? Merely have I gone on puzzling, as without influence, nothing may come of a life, and however briskly you may belabor me with Mr. Peach, yet who, I ask myself, through the watch when sleep comes not, may it have been, between mouthfuls of sandwich, as the spotted cubes went a-dancing, who dropped the decisive word about you? Don't tell me Emerson. Why, 'twas John Bird. Thought everyone knew that. As Mr. Bird's representative in the field, my duties to tend the sector, pray nothing goes too much amiss, requiring me to fix it. I'm the sector walla. Mason's response is a reverse squint, each eye, that is, doing the opposite of what it usually does when he peers through a telescope. Dixon finds it, briefly, disorienting. Mason even seems to be trying to smile in apology. The arts of leadership in me, how wanting, as all, alas, must know, I bear this command only thanks to a snarled and soiled web of favors, sales, and purchases I pray you may ever remain innocent of. You are right not to accept my command. Well, not all the time, as I may hope. Am I giving that impression? I'm sure I didn't mean to. You're the mystery, Dixon, not I. I'm but a peppercorn in the stafata, stirred and pushed about by any fool who walks by with a spoon, entirely theirs. No mystery about any of them. Dubious set of cooks though they be, nuff but the same old criminals, some dating back to Walpole. But your lot now, well, they're a different sort, aren't they? Recall last year, ingenuous. Cleves in London by the 1st of August. By the 11th of September, that is, the next thing anyone knows, the assignments are changed, with thee no longer his brother-in-law's second, rather leading a team of thy own, replaced by an unknown quantity. What am I to make of this? We scarcely know Maskline. Who is Robert Waddington, anyway? One of the Lunarian stalwarts, teaching the mathematics out near the monument someplace, intimate, indeed, housemate of one of the Pigots, those eminent advocates of taking the longitude by lunar culminations. Maskelyne's sort of lad? As Maskelyne will later tell Mason, Waddington from the outset was afflicted with a melancholy, lighter and faster, though no less lethal, than the traditional black sort. So how be ye, Robert? 2 weeks in Twickenham? How am I supposed to be? Strawberry Hill, Eel Pie Island, haven't I seen it all? Yet the fishing, 'tis said, oh, bleak easily the length of a man's hand. Ye take 'em with a maggot that dwells only upon that reach, quite unknown to the rest of Britain. And if beetles be your passion, why, the beetle variety there fair stupefies one. Pigots all well, I trust. A long stare. Where's the local round these parts, then? A moment's walk, though not as easy to get back from. Bit like life, isn't it? And that was in early January, with the transit of Venus yet 6 months off. They were going to be left together upon St. Helena, an island that, according to rumor, often drove its inhabitants insane. Tom Birch did happen to mention that 'twas Maskelyne who'd given him Mr. Waddington's address. He showed me his notebook. Maskelyne had written it in himself. It appears he preferred as his coadjutor the friend of the Pigots to the friend of the Peaches, thus allowing me to proceed in a single, unprotected little jackass frigate instead of his own giant Indiaman in a convoy with half the Royal Navy there as well to keep them safe. Allowing Dr. Bradley to step in, obtaining for thee the leadership of an additional observing team. and choosing you upon advice from Mr. Bird, author of the most advanced astronomical device in creation. Yes, yes, upon the face of it, quite straightforward, isn't it? And yet, do you not feel sometimes that everything since the fight at sea has been not a dream, yet, aye, as if we're lodgers inside someone else's fate, whilst belonging quite someplace else? Nothing's as immediate as it was. We might have died then, after all, and gone on as ghosts. Haunting this place, waiting to materialize, perhaps just at the moment of the transit, the moment the planet herself becomes solid. Even by then, the Reverend declares, upon some topics the astronomers remained innocent. That few usually believed this might have proved more than once an advantage in their strivings with the day. Had they known how disingenuous they appeared, they could have settled for much more than they ended up getting. Oh, uncle, how can you reckon so? By others who did far less and received more? And they're all dead, says Ethelmer, so what's it matter? Cousin, Tenebrae holding a bodkin in at least an advisory way. Ethelmer scowls in reply, what was a lambent spark in his eyes, now but silvered, cold reflection. Bree, your cousin proceeds unerringly to the despair at the core of history, and the hope. As savages commemorate their great hunts with dancing, so history is the dance of our hunt for Christ, and how we have fared. If it is undeniably so that he rose from the dead, then the event is taken into history, and history is redeemed from the service of darkness, with all the secular consequences flowing from that one event designed and willed to occur, including every crusade, inquisition, sectarian war, the millions of lives, the seas of blood, comments Ethelmer. What happened? He liked it so much being dead that he couldn't wait to come back and share it with everybody else? Sir, Misterly Spark upon his feet, save that for your next discussion with others of comparable wisdom. In this house we are simple folk, and must labor to find much amusement in jokes about the Savior. Ethelmer bows. Temporarily out of touch with my brain, he mumbles. Sorry, everybody, sir, Reverend, sir. Chapter 8. As the days here slip by, whilst the transit yet lies too distant for him quite to believe in, Dixon, assailed without mercy by his sensorium, almost in a swoon, finds himself, on nights of cloud, less and less able to forego emerging at dusk, cloaked against the Etesian wind, and making directly for the prohibited parts of town. Somewhere a tune in the musical mode styled by the East Indians Pelog, which they term appropriate to evening, bells quietly with him as he goes, keeping the rhythm of his stride, and he begins to whistle briskly along. After months of being told by masters-at-arms that he might not whistle aboard ship, any resumption of the vice comes as a freedom almost torpedic, particularly here, as he follows these increasingly unlighted lanes of hammered dust, with lawless bustle at every hand, black slaves carrying gamecocks, looking for a spot contest, bandyaten exiled from Batavia with their retinues of pygmies, women in veils, drosters down on business, sailors to whom every port of call's but another imitation of Wapping, and along the way, at each dimmed crossing, Cape Malays waiting with goods to sell, all of whom have soon come to know Dixon. Here, Tuan, best daga, cleaned, graded, ready for your flame. Real Dutch gin, bottles with the original seals, yes, intact as virgins. Latest ketchup, arrived express from Indochina, see? Pineapple, pumpelnose, tamarind, and 100 flavors, 1,000 blends. Invisible through the long Dutch work day, life in the Cape night now begins to unwrap everywhere. Dixon smells the broiling food, the spices, the livestock, the night-blooming vines, the ocean, voracious and immense. He is acquiring a nasal map of the town, learning in monitory whiffs to smell the watch. Pipes, sheep-fat suppers, pre-watch gin, and to take evasive action. Learning to lurk, become part of the night, close enough to slave-born lanterns passing by to feel their heat as easily as he may scent the burghers' wives through the curtains of their sedan chairs. The St. Helena coffee, English soap, French dampness. In the distance, the nightly curfew cannon barks, announcing Dixon's transition to the state of outlaw. He feels like a predatory animal, as if this town were ancient to him, his hunting ground, his fell, so misremembered in nearly all details, save where lie the boundaries he does not plan to cross. Though how can there be any room for excess in this gossip-ridden town, crowded up against the mountains that wall it from the virid, vast leagues of bushmen's land beyond, as behind these carved doors and gothical gates, in the far penumbra of sperm tapers, in loft and voorhees, in entryways scoured by dusk and blown sand, these Dutch carry on as if judgment be near as the towering seas, and nothing matter any more, especially not good behavior, because there's no more time. The bets are in, every individual fate decided, all cries taken by the great winds, and 'tis done. Temporarily, as geographically, the end of the world. The unrelenting vapor of debauchery here would not merely tempt a saint, heavens, would tempt an astronomer. Yet 'tis difficult, if not impossible, for these astronomers to get down to a chat upon the topic of desire, given Dixon's inability to deny or divert the gusts that sweep him, and Mason's frequent failure, in his melancholy, even to recognize desire, let alone to act upon it, though it run up calling, "Ahoy, Charlie!" "How could you begin to understand?" Mason sighs. "You've no concept of temptation. You came ashore here looking for occasions to transgress. Some of us have more backbone, I suppose." "A bodily part too often undistinguished," Dixon replies, "from a ramrod up the arse." Jet slides by in the narrow hallway. "Don't forget tonight, Charles," she sings. "I'll remember," mutters Mason, adjusting his wig. Dixon beams after her, then back at Mason. "Engaging youngster." "She is a fine young woman, Dixon, and I shan't hear a word more." "Tell me," blinks Dixon, "what did I say?" But Mason has already clambered away up the stairs. Passing through the hallway a bit later, Dixon observes Mason now in deep conversation with Greet, the two of them nervous as cats. "Mutton again this evening, I'm told," Dixon cries in cheery salute. The girl shrieks and runs off into the kitchen. Mason snarls. "Time hanging heavy? Is that it? What can I do to help? Just name it." "Why, I? Perhaps when the ladies have retired." Thus bickering, they pass into the dining room. After the Cape custom, the Dutchman has locked his front door for the evening meal, which he now regards smoldering, less predictable than an Italian volcano. "I see you have discovered another Cape delicacy, Mr. Dixon." Johanna, in an effort not to get into any verbal exchange with Mason, whilst her husband is in the room, "our Malays call it ketchup. Girls, don't even want you looking at it. Filthy Asian stuff." Cornelius commands through clouds of aromatic pipe smoke. "Even, puff, if something has to be done, puff, to cover up the taste of this food." Another volcanical emission, whilst he grimly attacks his slice of the evening's mutton in tail fat. Over the course of its late owner's life, the tail has grown not merely larger and more fatty, but also, having absorbed years of ovine flatulence ever blowing by, to exhibit a distinct taste, perhaps prized by cognoscenti somewhere, though where cannot readily be imagined. Dixon, meanwhile, is struggling with the very Chinese concoction, or rather with its slender bottle, out of whose long neck he finds he has trouble getting the stuff to flow. "Strike her up on the bottom," whispers Els, "and perhaps she will behave." Dixon does a quick triple take among the faces of the women, a jocularity poised upon his tongue, but peering out warily, not quite trusting the open. He notes, at the far corner of his visual field, Mason attempting to hide behind, perhaps even beneath, the food on his plate. Cornelius, president inside his blue tobacco fumulus, seems unaware of the tangle of purposes in the room. Greet is playing vigorously with locks of her hair, trying to remember what her sisters above and below think she does and doesn't know at this point in the saga, as against what her mother believes. What Mason may be thinking is, of course, unimportant to any of them. At last, the relentless supper done, the vrooms, as is their custom, retire out front to the step, Johanna and the girls swiftly choosing seats to windward of Cornelius and his watchfire, leaving the astronomers to light what pipes they may in self-defense. There is something irresistibly perverse, as the Reverend then noted, about a young white woman sitting upon a step in the evening, among a steady coming and going of black servants meant, as in the theater of the Japanese, to be read as invisible, whilst she poses all ashine, she and her friends. According to which steps they sit upon, and which are then claimed by the feet of young sparks who might wish to linger, the possible viewing angles, for both parties, are more or less multiplied, each combination of steps having its own elaborate codes for what is allowed and what transgresses, from eye play to the readjustment of skirts and underskirts, and the length of time 'tis considered proper to gaze. Some belles like to boss their male slaves about in front of the young men, whilst others wish to be caught gazing after girl slaves with unconcealed envy. Over the range of their desires, they are shameless, these Dutch girls of all ages, for they are the girls of the end of the world, and the only reason for anyone to endure church all day Sunday is to be reminded of the boundaries there to be o'erstepped. The more aware of their sins as they commit them, the more pleased be these Cape folk, more so than Englishmen, who tend to perish from the levels of remorse attending any offense graver than a leer. Slowly, gravely, the Yonkers dance up and down the steps in the evening. Their talk is of rooftops, archways, sheds, and warehouses, any place secure from traffic long enough for a skirt to be lifted or breeches unbuckled. Johanna keeps looking over at Mason, as if offering to translate. A young gallant arrives, bearing a diminutive three-stringed lute, and dropping to one knee before Jet, though she has delegated the sighing to her sisters, sings his own original paean to Cape womanhood. Oh, Cape girl, in the ocean wind, fairer than the full moon, secret as a sin. You're a light lass, so the lads all say, sitting on your step, hoping love will pass today. You keep your slaves about, as don't we all, yet no one in love is brave, and even a slave may fall in love with Cape girl, when southeasters blow, through my dreams I know, to your arms I'll go. Cape girl, don't say no. And self-accompanied whim, what is that tiny object in your lap that you've been whanging your triads upon, there and so rhythmically too? Found this down at that market near the gallows. 'Tis a Fiji Islander's guitar, first introduced there 200 years ago by Portuguese Jesuits, according to the Malay that sold me it. I see the Jesuit part clearly enough, Greet remarks. So long as you don't grasp it, murmurs Els. 'Tis an open enough game, with a level of calculation among these daughters of the Low Country, no less forgiving than the sort of thing that may be heard any slack time among the girls in the company brothel at the slave lodge. Two distinct worlds, the company maintaining their separation, setting prices, seeking as ever total control over the sex industry in Cape Town. Yet do there remain a few independents, brave girls and boys who are young enough to enjoy the danger of going up against the company. Sylphs of mixed race, mixed gender, who know how to vanish into the foothills and the Droster network, even finding safety beyond, in the land of the Hottentots. Yet 'tis difficult to leave the life in town, to give up that sudden elation when the ships appear round the headlands, Spanish dollars everywhere in golden infestation, every woman in town, from the stoniest white church pillar to the giddiest black bell inn from the hinterland, at once coming alert and even sometimes a jingle. The taverns are jumping. Sailors bring their pipes and fiddles ashore. Daga smoke begins to scent the air. Voices lift. Music pulses. The nights bloom like jasmine. 'Tis then Mason and Dixon are most likely to be out rambling among all the spices armies used to kill for, up in the Malay Quarter, a protruded tongue of little streets askew to the Dutch grid, reaching to the base of Table Mountain. The abrupt evening descends. The charcoal fires come glowing one by one to life, dotting the hillside. Night slowly fills with cooking aromas. Shrimp paste, tamarinds, coriander and cumin, hot chilies, fish sauces, and fennel and fenugreek, ginger and lengkua. Windows and doorways open to lives finite but overwhelming, households gathering against the certain night. Greet Vroom slips away with Alstra to follow the astronomers. They visit different kitchens and eat, she reports back to her sisters, nodding her head, a little out of breath. They wander about, eating and talking. Every now and then, they'll step into one of those seamen's taverns. What do they eat? Everything. Half of it is food you wouldn't dream of. Out in the dark where the Malays all feast, spices and vegetable treats from the east, peppers as hot as the hearth sides of hell, things that Papa has neglected to tell. Curried wild peacock and springbok ragu, bilimbi pickles and tamarinds, too. Bobo tea, fricadelle, fried porcupine, glasses abrim with Constantia wine, singing, pass me that plate, hand me that bowl, let's have that bottle, toss me a roll. Scoffing and swilling out under the sky, leaving the stars to go silently by. Greet, uncombed, sentimental greet, Jet gushes. It occurs to no one that what has driven the astronomers up the slopes of Table Mountain may be, at last, the Table Vroom. The pipe smoke, the sheep fat, the strange dinnerware, everything, dishes, spoons, yes, even twinkling through the mutton broth at the bottom of one spoon are these, well, stories. Battles, religious events, personages with rapt fizzes standing about in rays from above, pointing aloft at who knows what, violent scenes of martyrdom from the religious wars of the previous century, obscure moral instructions written in all but unreadable lettering, and in Dutch withal, framing the potatoes on one's plate, or encircling some caudal stafata being passed from eater to eater and rotated as it goes, so that each gets to view a separate episode of some forever obscure doctrinal dispute. Soon enough, Mason and Dixon are desperate. Pretending astronomical chores up at the observatory, bowls and cutlery concealed in their cloaks, they steal away, thinking of oceanic fish, African game, hot peppers, spices of the East. I believe in vibrations, declares Mason. I believe that vibrations from that horrid family get into their food, which is difficult enough to enjoy to begin with. And I'd rather be out here. Why, aye, as far projected into the sea, each will confide as land may go, out blessedly alone upon the furthest point, nothing beyond but the uninterrupted planetary seas of the 40s, the West Wind Express, and the regions of ice, and the mystery at the exact other pole, the night fog creeping like quicksilver, all but surrounded by a waste where the seas might grow higher than either astronomer can imagine without fear, set up and waiting for a southern star, Lumina, of a shapely constellation unnamed, forever below any British horizon to culminate. They have come upon a queue forming up a dark street and decide to join it. Dixon, in his red coat, boots with 3-inch heels, and mysteriously cockaded hat. Mason, after an hour before his traveler's mirror, having assumed rather a darkened, volish neutrality. As they move slowly towards the makeshift kitchen tent, more and more of its candlelit interior may be seen. A man in a sarong cooks as though possessed, running about with a crease to gaze too long at whose bright, wavy edge might put a man's thumbs a prickle, as his mind in a bind. Poking embers precisely into huge gusts of flame, stirring the contents of various pots, peeling garlic, deveining and butterflying shrimps, slicing vegetables, boning and filleting fish, performing perhaps a dozen such tasks more or less simultaneously with the single implement, whilst beds of embers glow, and from iron pans rise huge clouds of smoke and steam, so fragrant that breathing them is like eating the first plateful of a large meal. And his wife hands the food out the window and collects the money, and older children carry and prepare, whilst younger ones tend the babies in the dark, watching the progress of the crease, which they have seen fly, heard sing, and in the presence of a pure well, felt a tremble, there being an odd number of waves to its blade, signifying alliance with the correct forces. Amazing, Mason somehow having fallen into conversation with one of the children. In my country, near my home, since the mills came, our pure wells have been well hidden, and we must now ask dowsers who use long hazel wands in much the same way to find them. Have the Dutch conquered your land, too? Oh, dear me, no. Mason primed to chuckle in condescension till Dixon, infernally abeam, says, William of Orange, what about him? Thou wouldn't style that a conquest? Captain Jerry, good evening. The saute deluxe as usual? Looks bonny, Rockman. What are those yellow bits there? Mangoes, still on the green side tonight, but tomorrow's the day. Accordingly, next morning at the first risen gull's cry, Hey, Mason, the mangoes are in. Bring me back a likely one, Mason mutters, and perhaps I shan't kill you. Yet, out of something like duty owed his senses, he finds himself shambling down to the market, yawning in the sun, there to behold mountains of the fruit, apparently all come to ripeness at the same moment, causing a panic, for all must then be picked in a short time from the groves up country and rushed directly to town, to lie in these towering heaps, waiting to be lifted and appraised, as they find the Reverend Wick's cherry coke doing when they arrive. Well met, gentlemen. What a morning! One feels, as Adam felt, even better, as Eve. I shall kill him now, Mason declares. Hey, get the old nozzle down upon this one, Mason. A beauty, is it not? The aroma captures Mason's attention. Aye, thou'd better eat that un, now thy nose has been all over it. Why don't I throw it at you instead? They are soon retired to a nearby step, where they sit eating mangoes. Neighboring steps are similarly occupied. Thought you'd sailed, Dixon says. The Seahorse proceeds without me. East of the Cape, Captain Grant was pleased to inform me, men of Christ are not desired, though why, he refused to say, even when I suggested that if clergy be banned, then what is contemplated out there must be too terrible to speak of, in any way but secretly. I, personally, am looking for that bastard Sanfu, Captain Grant declared. My Seahorse is a damned snappy little package, and I suppose I've grown to love her, for her honor has become important to me. Shall I be safer in Cape Town? Inquired the Reverend. Safe enough. You shouldn't have long to wait. India men come through all the time, though they are most inflexibly anti-clerical folk. Their cargo spaces are purposely built a ton short to avoid the law that requires a chaplain on board. So you'd do better to represent yourself in some other line of work. I could pretend to be an astronomer, Dixon says. All I need to know, I can teach thee in 5 minutes. Surveying won't even take that long, snaps Mason. Piss runneth downhill, and payday is Saturday. Now you're a qualified fence runner. The Reverend holds aloft a mango as if it were a host. Had I gone, I should have missed this. Regard how the fruit takes its shape and feel from this great seed case within, which the Spanish call el hueso, the bone. This mango handles like flesh. To peel it is to flay it. To bite into it is to eat uncooked flesh. Though I can imagine as well uncomfortable religious questions arising. Mason, who has been shocked by impieties far more venial, might have shared his moral displeasure were the topic not food, allowing him promptly to advert to his own Iliad of dietary misfortune here among the Dutch. Their emphasis upon roots, the eternal boiling, the absence of even salt, we have already reviewed. 'Tis the sheep. Heaven forfend we should ever find a moment without sheep in it. Sheep, where I come from, are more important than all but a few humans. A boy is as likely to learn to skate upon a shearing floor as upon the ice. The smell, at some times of year sensible for miles, of sheep and wool fat, and that queasy nidor of lambs baking in ovens meant for bread, the very nasal patina that met me here upon entering my first Dutch house of mutton fat vaporized and recondensed again and again, working its way insidiously over the years of cooking, into all walls, furniture, draperies within a certain radius of that kitchen. Ah! How foolishly did I believe I'd escaped these perfumes of Gloucestershire. Nay, at the Dutchman's table I am returned to them, as to a kind of hell. The young clergyman nods in apparent sympathy. Then eating Malay food seems a cheap enough deliverance, bearing in mind that the cuisine of a people whose recreations include running amok is necessarily magical in purpose and effect, and no one is altogether exempt. Later that night, writing in his journal, adding, "Lamb of God, Eucharist of bread, what Mr. Mason could not bear were the very odors of blood sacrifice and transubstantiation, the constant element in all being the oven, the altar wherebefore his father presided." A few pages later, he admits, "Of course, 'twas none of my affair. Yet such was the unease of those days, as I waited for a ship to convey me further east, that I sought distraction in the study of other lives, usually without their principals knowing of it. So found we ourselves, for the moment, as some might say, beached, just here, upon the brink of all the Indies, before the unfolding, fearful, and inexhaustible of the East." Chapter 9. Despite all wish to avoid it, here they are, Vrouw Vroom and Mason, in an upper bedroom, in unshuttered afternoon light, swiftly fading, hearkening to each sound in the house, waiting for the bull's eye, a strange dark cloud with a red center, to appear over Table Mountain and grow swiftly till but minutes later the northwester shall sweep upon them. "I am not one of these Cape women," she is whispering, "though I have ever envied their reputations. Next to Cornelius, so dreamt I, must other men figure as Adonises, and I should certainly have my pick. Alas, whenever in earnest I have tried to flirt, each time my choice proves to be worse than Cornelius. I ought to have given up and settled for being a churchly ideal." And instead, Mason finds to his surprise that he cannot refrain from inquiring, his jealousy none the less more peevish than substantial. Misunderstanding, she hangs her head, in lewd innocence, erring upon the side of Eros, and whispers, "I have chosen to be a very wicked woman." Who, it seems, will commit any sin? Giggling awkward as a girl, her face aglow, the first time he's observed her thus. She has been trying to unbutton her bodice. The trembling in her hands and the failing light resist her. At last, with a small growl, she grabs both sides of the garment and rips it in two, or actually twain. The light in the room is darkening with unnatural speed, turning her nipples and mouth black as ashes, her fair hair nearly invisible. There is a sudden hammering upon the door. Mason jumps up and runs round the room twice before locating the window, which, without looking back, he raises, climbs through, and vanishes from with a receding wail and a thump somewhere below. In runs Jet. "Charles, we've only 5 minutes. Oh, hello, Mama." "What would Mr. Mason be doing here, my imp?" inquires Mary Johanna. "What's happened to your bodice?" In a corner, the darkling beetle rustles in its cage. Its elytra, the same unforgiving white as the great sand waste called Kalahari, lying north of here, where the creature was taken up, brought leagues overland to the Cape with hundreds of its kind, arriving hungry and disoriented, to be set out with others, like a great sugar-iced confection, at some harborside market frequented by sailors and the strange. So far in its life, it has never seen rain, though now it can feel something undeniably on the way, something it cannot conceive of, perhaps as humans apprehend God, as a force they are ever just about to become acquainted with. The storm arrives and goes on for the next 3 days. Cornelius, up country, is prevented by floods from returning. The logistics are both simple and hellishly next to impossible, for though the guest rooms at Zeman's lie empty, Dixon being across town at a certain Malay establishment, reined in like everyone else, and Mason is known for not responding to knocks upon the door, yet is Johanna obliged to arrange plausible absences from her daily schedule, with dozens of sets of eyes, within the house and outside it, scrutinizing her every step. No sooner, for example, is her mother out the door than in comes bouncing Els, all a-soak. "It's fantastic," she cries, "the season I live for. Come, Charles, do the English kiss in the rain?" Down the street, somebody's roof collapses in a sodden rumble. All structural surfaces here, even vertical ones, touched by rain, begin at once to take up water like great rigid sponges, and after enough of it, dissolving, crumble away. A bell upon a rooftop begins to ring. Fruit peels lie squashed and slippery in the gutters that run down to the canals, where the slaves are out in the storm, doing their owner's laundry, observing and reading each occurrence of blood, semen, excrement, saliva, urine, sweat, road mud, dead skin, and other such data of biography, whose pure form they practice daily before all is lixiviated neath heaven. In the rainy day shadows beneath the arcades, pipes full of tobacco pulse brightly and bob about in front of watchful faces. Everything smells of wet lime and sewage. A strayed sheep cowers against a wall too high for it, bleating fretfully. Mason is not having fun. "Chase me," at last demands the mischievous Snip, and away she shoots up the lane and gone. No matter how he rotates his hat, Mason cannot prevent a stream of water from funneling somewhere onto his person. He arrives back at the Vroom, skidding in the mud, wig powder running down his shoulders and lapels in a white lead wash. The door is locked. Inside, he hears Els and her sisters laughing. Furious, he stalks through the downpour around to the back, locates a ladder and props it against a balcony whose window seems open, but when he gets to it, it is not. With no more than a precarious hold upon the balcony, Mason now feels activity beneath his soles, and looks down in time to see the ladder being deftly abstracted and taken round the corner in malicious fun by Jet, who is for some reason feeling underappreciated today. As he hangs there in misery, tasting ocean salt in the wind, watching in a spirit of distance, soon, he mutters aloud, to be detachment, the bolts connecting the house to the balcony, which was never meant to bear much more weight than that of an adolescent female's foot, begin to slide, protesting with horrid sucking shrieks out of the lime and sand that have held them there so ornamentally till now. "What?" he is heard to exclaim. "Not again." Before jumping clear of the falling ironwork, landing, mercifully, without more than contusions and pain, upon the soaked earth. This time he decides to lie for a while, as he imagines in surrender to the forces of nature, allowing heaven's rains to visit as they will. After a bit, he notices a peculiar weight to the drops striking his face, and withal a distinctly lateral motion, as of something actually crawling.